or the office of the majority leader, and so forth. I will not go into the pros and cons of this, but we'll leave it to you later, perhaps, to look at some of the things I've had here. Another approach to the problem, of course, is a package of environmental legislation attacking specific problems, which is the way Kentucky has approached this. This sort of gives a burst of activity. I mean, you have a burst of activity and pass a lot of legislation, but if no new organizational mechanisms are set up, you still have no way of getting this overall view of what's happening to the environment. Sometimes this approach gives the appearance of bold action, but sometimes the approach also tends to treat symptoms rather than the causes of the problem. Another possibility is periodic environmental conferences, and I see John's pushing me on here. He wants to set up periodic environmental conferences sponsored by the executive or the legislative branch or both, are useful, of course, in drawing attention to problems and in searching for points of policy agreement, but they are clearly inadequate for coming to grips with environmental problems over the long term. As I say, I will get this to you, and you can maybe look at some of these different approaches. Wait a minute, John, I'm not through. There is a further alternative, not in the preceding list that I went through. It represents a policy of reaction to crisis situations rather than action in a forward-looking and positive sense. And unfortunately, it's an alternative which many states appear to be following. The underlying premise of this is just to wait and see and to form a temporary or an ad hoc advisory group after an environmental problem has reached critical proportions. God help Alaska if it continues to follow this course of action. I think the things that I've suggested here are only suggestions, and there are great possibilities of these are things that have been tried or are contemplated elsewhere. There are great possibilities for Alaska to go even far beyond this in initiating altogether new approaches that may be the model for the rest of the nation.
Thank you, Jack. That was a real good job, Dick, and thank you for it. And you laid it out there very well, and it was policy-oriented, and we certainly have gotten some very good suggestions here how we might think about an Alaskan environmental policy. And I didn't feel too badly about pushing Dick on this. For one thing, we did get started late. Second thing is that he's going to be able to talk in the morning and finish anything that he didn't have to say to you this morning. He'll have time tomorrow morning. I'm always impressed with these people. Professor Cooley is an ecologist, an economist, and a geographer. He walks from one department of the university to another department with the greatest of ease. This is a real achievement. He knows all about polar bears and all kinds of interesting things that he has had the chance to learn in the course of his rather short career. Our second speaker this morning, Edward Higbee. Yes, John.
John, before we go on talking about the great environment outdoors, is there something about this guy's
name?
Can you either turn up the acoustics or turn off the
acoustics? Well, I don't know. I thought the acoustics worked. I don't think about it.
That's just the recording.
We haven't got any acoustics. Well, turn off the air conditioner. Go ahead and tell Mrs. Pence, tell the young lady to turn the air conditioner off. Turn it off. Better do what? Well, the suggestion has been made. I didn't make it. The suggestion's been made if we turn off the air conditioner that we turn off the smoking. So put out the pollution. We can start with environmental control. You can see the kind of a response you get to environmental control
even when it's at such a level as this. So you can imagine when you try to impose environmental control on something important. I mentioned Professor Cooley's career because our second speaker, Edward Higbee, has been, in the course of his career, an agronomist, an anthropologist, and a geographer. He has been a consultant to a number of countries. He knows all about the agriculture of Japan or of Vietnam, of the old Indochina area. He knows all about it, the agriculture of the Middle East. He lived with the Indians of the Amazon River Valley for a time and learned all about the Indians of the Amazon River and wrote about them. He became a geographer and a protege of the great Isaiah Bowman. He has been interested in land all of his life. In his most recent years as professor of land utilization at the University of Rhode Island, he's been particularly interested in land use and the impact of land use on the institutions and the people of the American and other societies. And so I ask Dr. Higbee if he would trace for us some of the implications of the shift that's taking place as we move from a natural to a man-made environment and point out the implications of this transformation for policy formulation. I'm going to ask Ed to get through that as fast as he can so that we can get about our business of talking about it. Ed, it's good to have you here with us.
Well, it certainly is presumptuous from somebody from the smallest state in the union to come to the largest state in the union and expect I have anything relevant to say, especially as I arrived in Alaska for the first time 2 days ago. I've had a great walk up 4th Street and down 5th Street and a high altitude view from the crow's nest. I arrived at night, so I didn't even see Alaska from the airplane as I came in. Why am I here? Well, if I have anything relevant to say, you'll have to say to yourselves how it applies to Alaska. Obviously, I'm not going to suggest what Alaska should do. I have been interested in land use, and I won't even get around to discussing the specifics of land use until my second appearance. Because in dealing with these problems of land use, I don't know how effective this is. Can you hear back there? Oh. The problems of land use, I find that they change so drastically with technological change and with the consequent institutional change and with the changes in the ways people think because of changes in technology, that to deal directly with land without considering the context in which land policy is made would be futile. And to discuss land use in Alaska would be even more so. But I hope that what I have to say about technological change, and basically that's one of the fundamental aspects of what I call urbanization, I will have to deal with the implications on land use as a result of these technological and institutional changes. Now, this context is altering worldwide. There is a worldwide shift, and I think that this has direct application to those who believe that the great wealth of our time lies in natural resources. And if I have any image of Alaska or how Alaskans think about themselves, it is that this is a great storehouse of natural resources only waiting for exploitation. I'm sorry if I attempt to disillusion you on this point, but it seems from a review of changes in world technology that the very nature of natural resources is only a reflection of technological development, and therefore there is no such thing as a permanent long-range storehouse of natural resources. I suppose if one could use an example of that, you knew for a long time that there was oil on the North Slope. I mean, that was established as a naval reserve a long time ago. It was not until the technology of exploitation had reached its present sophisticated stage that you really began to invite and receive the interests of those worldwide institutions that exploit the natural resources and the oil reserves such as you have. And the great oil companies have finally come here because the technology in oil exploitation has reached its present stage. Now, two-thirds of the world is still involved and committed to an existence depending upon the natural resources of the environment. And those two-thirds of the world are what we would call today the undeveloped or the underdeveloped areas of the globe. The part of the globe which we call the developed or urbanizing is the part which is now able to take relatively unusable natural resources and through technological devices to make them usable. Now, I must present this to you in a somewhat abstract manner. These technological changes are accelerating due to what we call the knowledge explosion. But basically what is happening is that we are developing means of transferring our energy from the energy of human beings and animals to the inanimate energy resources that are being made available through the consumption of fossil fuels and the harnessing of hydroelectric potential. And if there's anything in this that seems to me to be significant from the Alaskan point of view, it is the great potential here of developing inanimate energy sources. These inanimate energy sources mean that the greater the energy input, the less rich the natural resources need to be in their natural state. We can look forward, and some people in the Bureau of Standards look forward to the time when we may draw much of our mineral resources directly from the sea or from ordinary granitic rock. It's a process of determining the know-how for recovery and of a continuing disparity between the cheap cost of electricity and the value of the resource that results. And if one looks over the nature of economic evolution in this country over the last 20 or 30 years, one of the astonishing facts is that the cost of electricity has increased less than the cost of products, natural resources, or the increase in personal income. So that I would say, as a broad national and international trend, the very fact that the relative costs of inanimate energy are declining relative to the value of the end product. And this is the great reward of technological innovation. So that we might look upon what is happening in our broad world context as an increasing, accelerating curve of change. Now, if we plan landscapes for permanence, and I'll come to this more specifically later, we will be building in rigidities in our landscape policies and our landscape designs, which may very well prove to be a handicap in our desire to exploit the opportunities of evolving technology. I don't want to go into any specifics on land policy at this moment, but I do wish to point out that if we are in a period of accelerating technological change, we are going to be in a period also of accelerating institutional change and that to attempt to build landscapes as a principle, to attempt to build landscapes for permanent arrangements in terms of the technology of our time would, in the end, lock us in to the constraints of the present, which obviously will not exist in 20 or 30 years from now if this curve of acceleration that I'm talking about holds true. And that curve of acceleration is apparent not only in the increasing amount of inanimate energy per capita, which is being generated and more importantly used, and the knowledge explosion, that is the accumulation of knowledge and the building on the knowledge of the past, which makes it possible through specialization to go to advanced stages in almost all fields. The rise in per capita incomes of net constant dollars, this is a very real factor in our lives, and it has almost nothing to do with the expenditures of individual energies. It has to do with the fact that the efficiencies of technology are giving us, as individuals, increasing real dollar income, spendable income. I can put it this way, that despite inflation and despite taxation, this is net income per capita after taxes and after inflation is, on the average, twice as high for my generation as for my father's, and four times as high as for my grandfather's. And there's every expectation that this will continue. This means more leisure, and this means more mobility. And if I want to apply this to landscape, it would mean looking at landscapes in terms of planning for flexibility and change rather than planning for any kind of permanence such as we know at the moment. I understand there's consideration of building highways to Nome and so forth. In terms of this kind of abstract analysis, it would seem at this particular moment to be a rather rash public investment, considering what's there and how easy it would be to carry on present negotiations by air. All of this is going to make our attitudes toward resources and toward landscapes obsolete. Our traditional belief systems are really psychological adaptations to the constraints of the present. I think this is one of the key issues that I'd like to raise with you in more detail later, that our minds basically are a facility which enables us to accommodate to our environment. If that environment is too bad, one of the accommodations is to go insane. And to live in a world of dreams and illusions, to become schizophrenic rather than to face reality. I just cite that extreme to indicate that psychologists do tell us that each of us sees the world differently. And this is understandable because we know nothing about the world except what we have learned from experience. And each of our experiences is different. And as social groups, we come to certain concepts about our environment which are accepted in common. And these are our traditional belief systems. And I would say that one of the handicaps that we have as human beings throughout the world at the moment is that our minds are conditioned to an agrarian past rather than to an urban present or the potentials of the kind of urban society that I've been discussing in terms of technological evolution. To me, the urban world which is emerging is an entirely new ecological environment. It is not a matter of building gridiron street patterns and physical office and shop building shells. That's only an incidental consequence. Urbanization, to me, is a total environmental phenomenon. And it is in its rawest stage of early development. And when one looks at the six cities around the world, it is quite obvious that the conditions that they are in are the conditions of early experimental trial and error efforts, which really don't measure up to the potentials of the future. The physicist philosopher Alfred North Whitehead said that ideas which are really significant practically destroy the societies in which they emerge. And I would suggest that the world at this moment is engaged in a transfer of ideas about its environment which all but shatter the nature of societies worldwide. And if this is true, not only will our concepts of land utilization be changing, but our total concept about ourselves as societies. Now, just to give an example of what I consider obsolete technology in which we are committed ideologically at the moment, and not only because we are committed ideologically, we are committed financially through our governmental institutions. And these commitments to the past make it impossible to commit ourselves with real freshness and vigor to the opportunities of the future, which are in the process of invention. John Osman referred this morning to the work of Frederick Jackson Turner and the emphasis on the frontier. Most of the continental southern portion, 48 states of the Union, were settled during the period in which people felt that their security could be identified with the possession of land. And therefore, the greatest contribution which our society could make to the stability of the family and the welfare of its people was to see that there was a fair allocation of land which would make it possible for families and individuals to exert their energies and their hopes and produce a livelihood. Well, there is every evidence today that this, while it was true at a time, in terms of today's technology, the idea that a man should make a living from the exploitation of land with meager capital resources, but the great muscular and spiritual resources of his family are completely out of line with reality. And thus we see the problem that exists in Appalachia, the problem which exists on the Great Plains of farmers with small holdings who can't possibly take advantage of the new technologies of modern agriculture. These technologies are so astonishing, and their evolution is so rapid, that one could almost look forward to the time in the year 2000, as some people in the Bureau of Standards are already looking forward to that time, when agriculture as we now know it, even in its most intensive stages in the irrigated valleys of Arizona and Southern California, may be on its way out. What would that mean then in terms of a state agricultural policy in a frontier region such as Alaska? If it is already a problem for the small undercapitalized farmer in the 48 states where they've had 100 years of opportunity to make a go of things. And this has resulted, because of our commitment to such an obsolete concept of human welfare, to a present misappropriation of the federal wealth to the tune this year, this fiscal year, which ended on June 30th, of $8.4 billion. You have a realization now of what $8.4 billion is now that you have gotten almost $1 billion out of your leases on the North Slope. And if you look at your budget, you realize that you could spend that very quickly and have relatively little to show for it. I'm thinking of the budget of the state of Rhode Island, we could only get by for 3.5 years on that amount, and our present budgets really don't take care of our public needs. So if the smallest state in the union would find $900 billion, would it be quite a windfall, but it really, over the long pull, couldn't do us much good. Then $8.4 billion, which is now being spent by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, supposedly, for the most part, to prop up an obsolete system of small family farm operations, but most of those billions going, of course, to the very large, efficient, highly capitalized operations, you begin to see the effect of obsolete ideals on present real public policy. And there is a need to see how locked in we are to these concepts. Now, let me say something, because obviously I don't think too many people in Alaska view the future of agriculture and grazing as being a great industry. If they do, then they must anticipate, I would say, exceedingly heavy public costs in return for the economic gain. I mentioned that the farmers in the other states are getting in the neighborhood of $8.4 billion in subsidies and services, and they are paying in taxes to local governments, state governments, and federal governments about $1.7 billion. So it would be perfectly possible to subsidize and keep families afloat in obsolete agricultural occupations, and I include grazing with that, but not expect very great public returns, but expect very great public commitments. Now, let's translate that to our concept of the city as we have grown up with it. Our concept of the city in the past has been something, if we just take an area like this, a circular area, and put a city in the middle of it, and then connect it with farm-to-market roads, then you've got the traditional classical city in symbiotic relationship with its hinterland, the hinterland supplying it with raw materials and the city in return providing the countryside with manufactured materials and management. Now, that kind of city and landscape is one that anticipates permanence. So you put great investment. I like to think of the kinds of investments that were put into the landscape of rural and agrarian New England, where I come from. If you travel through that part of the world, you'll see in the woods today a great number of stone walls. Some people say, well, why'd the Indians build those? But historically, if any of you are from England, you know that all that land at one time was cleared and very laboriously walled by people who expected that their children and grandchildren to the nth generation to come would have security in that kind of land holding. Then it was worthwhile that the public should invest in this permanent situation. But now specializations developing throughout the world make this kind of city obsolete. And all over the United States, the other 48 states, this is not so true of Hawaii because of the large type of highly capitalized agriculture that's characteristic of at least the commercial agriculture of Hawaii. All over this part of rural America, small towns are dying. This is one of the problems of the rural countryside. That having made these investments personally and publicly in such a landscape of permanence, and then having the technologies of the time render them obsolete, we find very distressing human social problems arising out of it. And the kind of attention being paid to Appalachia today and to the Great Plains area is evidence of that. It's a misappropriation of the public wealth to try and sustain them. I would like now to introduce a concept of what the modern city function might be, rather than to live in reciprocation or symbiotic association with an immediate hinterland. which would mean if you take a large area such as Alaska and pepper it with cities here and there, and all of them having a little hinterland around them with mines and forests and farms, you can see that if technology changes to such an extent as to render these operations obsolete, because I'm saying that natural resources are only relative to a stage of technological evolution, then one could imagine a landscape in which the hopes and investments of the present would simply become a constraint upon the hopes and standards of living of the future. I think the reality of the modern city worldwide is its executive function in managing and interconnecting a worldwide network or system. And this brings us to the point you were talking about the reading assignment, John, earlier this morning, of the coming age of telecommunications, and with that one could classify air communications. That the present systems of highway communication in the minds of quite a few forward-looking engineers are already obsolete. And I understand that many of the precedents set in Alaska are precedents that have come straight out of Seattle. One only has to take a look at what has happened to Seattle as a result of the highway engineers having accomplished their purpose to realize what a predicament one can get in and how much of the public wealth can be misspent, because I understand now that they have practically torn the city apart and put up these new spectacular raceways, that they're going to have to go into a mass transportation system to really handle the problem. Is that right, Dick? Well, you want to take a ride over, if you haven't, over that Seattle system, and realize what an enormous investment can be made in an obsolete technology by an action agency which hasn't coordinated with other agencies dealing with the environment. The highway departments, with their very large purses, have been able to bull their way through and do whatever they wish with the environment because they have the wealth to do so, and the contracts to award, which is very appealing, of course, and the kind of political influence which these contracts entail. I would like, if the time permits, or if you want me to go on, because I can cut in here at any time, because you understand, okay. I would like to ask you if what I'm saying now has any relevance to your problems, because only you, knowing Alaska and living in Alaska, can say whether this is relevant or not. But I would like to suggest that mankind, ever since our species have been on Earth for some million years, has known only three basic ecological situations. That for most of that time, 99.9% of that time, he was a hunter and gatherer. And I suppose there are no people in the United States who have a better concept of how few people can be accommodated and supported by the exploitation of the natural environment, because you still have people in Alaska who are attempting to do so. And John mentioned that I've had some experience in the Amazon, and there one finds people who are able to do that at this time also. But the carrying capacity of land under those conditions is extremely low. For the whole United States, including Alaska, it was assumed by anthropologists that the land could carry only about 500,000 people. And as you know, the tribes divided the lands and jealously guarded them by tribal warfare and so forth. That it was almost technologically impossible for more than very small groups, social groups, to live together because of the sparseness of the natural resources directly usable in the techniques of the time. Down where I come from Narragansett Bay, which has a higher carrying capacity certainly than the tundra, it's been estimated that a hunter would be able to go out walking from his village 10 miles and come back 10 miles in a day and bring something back with him. And that therefore he would be able to, the whole group would be able to cover a territory of about 300 square miles. And the Narragansett Bay area of Rhode Island is one of the more productive. It compares with the Puget Sound region of Washington, where fairly high population densities for primitive man occurred. You couldn't have groups of about more than 50 people, and I suppose here in the tundra, it'd only be certain seasons when that many people could get together. So that society was never very complicated. It's a face-to-face society. And it was possible for a group to determine who was the best hunter and who was the natural leader among men. And when he got to be too old and died, of course, he would be replaced. There's no hereditary leadership. It was a world of very small groups of people, very primitive social organization, muscular energy societies, and feeding directly on natural resources. Then for about 10,000 years past, man has been able to modify that natural environment by means of agriculture and animal husbandry, the domestication of animals and so forth. Now you say, why am I going into something like this? Is this really so academic that it's irrelevant? I think it's not irrelevant because we have come into an urban age which is very, very recent with a value system and an outlook which is more conditioned, I would say, by our 10,000 years background as farmers and animal husbandrymen than is generally appreciated. Now, under such an agrarian system, it would be possible to modify the natural landscape, use selected plants and domesticated animals, and greatly increase the carrying capacity of good, rich lands. So much so that possibly a city surrounded by a hinterland of such farms could maintain a population of 200,000 or 300,000 people. And you begin to get the rise of the great cities of the Middle East in ancient times, even prehistoric times. And quite obviously, when you get that many people, you can't have this face-to-face social arrangement. And the social structure becomes more complex. And our familiarity with that structure is what we can see today in the agrarian countries, is basically a feudal society. The problem of India at the present time is Indira Gandhi is having with the syndicate is basically an attempt to bring India into an urban age, but confronted with the political opposition of the feudal lords. And this is typical of the situation in Latin America. It's typical of much of the situation in Southeast Asia. These are still muscular energy societies, human and animal. And they have such a limited capacity that if populations begin to multiply due to the kinds of death control which modern science has made possible, you begin to get internal social tensions of the kind now that are racking our world. I would suggest that the third ecology which man has known is only now emerging, the urban ecology. One of a synthetic environment, a man-made environment, and one which is characteristically capable of using inanimate energy. Now, why is that significant? I would like to give an alternative name to this age as the Einsteinian age. And in that sense, it's been with us only about 25 years. Really. And that's not time enough for our minds to adjust to the character, the real character of our environment. As a matter of fact, those who are still in very influential policy-making positions in our world, particularly in the Congress with its seniority rights and so forth, we have people who were adult before the Einsteinian age. And what do I mean by that? Well, you're familiar with the equation E equal mc square, or energy is mass times the square of the speed of light. In other words, it means that if man has the intelligence, the technology, to release this energy, there is an unlimited potential for the transmutation of our resources from presently unusable states to usable states. And that throws out completely all the ideology that has had to do with the Malthusian approach, the Darwinian approach, or the Marxian approach. And I would say that if this holds true, that any kind of political division of the world based on ideologies is completely obsolete, and any public commitment to such ideologies by way of military spending is obsolete. And you're beginning already, I think, to observe that here in Alaska, in the fact that the great bases which were built are now probably more of a problem to you, or will be even more so in the future, than they were a spur to your economic development only a very short time ago. And worldwide, this is not yet recognized, because something like $150 billion are being spent by societies which can hardly afford it, including ourselves, because we have far more important things to do with that kind of money. Because also, if this approach, this commitment to military support of obsolete ideologies were really effective, there wouldn't be anything left to be ideological about. So that if Fairbanks had a great base, and it were to spur the economy of Alaska by being built even larger, if it were really successful, it might be the first target for the annihilation. And that wouldn't be a very great satisfaction, I'm sure. This is the predicament that the whole world is in. And obviously the balance of power now exists, or the capability. And I would suggest that this is an outgrowth of our belief that security is to be found in land and natural resources, rather than that security should be found now in the development of our talents and institutions, and that a position, employment, if you will, legitimate status within the institutional structures of our society has replaced land as a basis of security. And that this is one of the major objectives of our time. Just as an indication of why the kind of economy built on agriculture may be phasing out, I'd just like to give you a few notations from persons who apparently are familiar with the nature of new processes of producing proteins and carbohydrates. The microbiological fermentation of petroleum waste, and this is where you might really become the great food supplier of the world, is 2,500 times more efficient in terms of time than the production of proteins by the use of beef cattle. It's just absolutely amazing how fast microbacteriological activity can function. So far, we've taken advantage of our microbiological activities and the fermentation of beers and so forth. We can go far beyond that now. And as for carbohydrate, it was suggested by a knowledgeable physicist in the Bureau of Standards that we could secure all the sugars that we need by the proper digestion of old newspapers. One might say that the Boy Scout drive would be the future agricultural activity of the country. If the morning news is undigestible, it can be made more palatable by supper time. It sounds like a joke, but I believe that possibly by the year 2000, some of these things may be seriously considered. Now, I can cut off at this moment, because I do have an opportunity to come back to you later. But I would just like to reemphasize the fact that our old notions that populations were exceeding resources have left out a calculation of the Einsteinian equation and the capacity of the modern research development process to find means of constantly doing more with less. And I'm just amazed that when you find an Arctic situation or subarctic situation as you have here, that you're still building the same kind of structures that one would find in Wichita, considering the kind of climate and time regime such as you have here, there's not much point in depending upon daylight at this time of year. It would be time to innovate with structures that require far less materials because the techniques of such structures are already available. And the kinds of cities that are being built need not follow the pattern of the past, but I understand that possibly one reason is that the engineers and contractors that are employed to build these structures know only those techniques. And recently, a presidential commission was appointed to investigate new techniques for building structures more efficiently and cheaper. And of all the people that they appointed to the members of the commission were people who are interested in present material supply and present union representatives. The report which they made, of course, you could anticipate its conclusion was that they thought that they were as efficient now as they could possibly be in the future, which is necessary, of course, to appoint committees of quite different personnel. People whose interests are deeply committed to the present are the last people to be consulted about the possibilities of the future.
Thank you, Ed, very much for this very provocative presentation. We do have coffee for you when we break up here. Let me make a couple of adjustments. I don't know, I had nothing to do with the coffee last evening. I got about a dozen complaints asking me not about the quality of the coffee, but asked me why it was costing 15 cents. I did not order any coffee. Somebody else was an entrepreneur last evening. I'm sorry to say I wasn't that clever. And I don't know anything about it, so you just can eliminate me from your consideration. Let me remind you, the Alpha section meets here in the Pioneer Hall all day, right back there. The Delta section meets here in Pioneer Hall. That's the room on the other side all day, including the evening. The Beta section meets in the Easter Island room over at the Captain Cook. And the Gamma section in the Voyager room over to Captain Cook all day. Now, we meet back here at, we meet back here at 1:30. And we'll have a presentation this afternoon then by John Eberhardt and possibly we'll have a presentation by John Eberhardt, who is going to take up this matter of the technological adjustment to the Alaskan ecology and talk about the creating of new systems for use here in Alaska. And I think you'll be extremely helpful here. Ed, you set the stage very beautifully for John Eberhardt's presentation this afternoon. And I believe that there is nothing else that I need to say except that several people, in fact maybe too many, have said something to me about dissent and desire to have some record made of their dissent from some of the policy positions that might be taken by the policy planning sections or by the conference as a whole. And I suggest that I report to you, we've talked about this in our staff meetings, and it is understood that when there is a policy position presented, that if you want to record your dissent, you feel free to do so, because this is your privilege, and we want to have that put into the record. I'm sure that you understand that, and you'll do with it. I had one other thing. I am trying to get these policy statements put together. And I have some of them, and you've gotten a good many of them. In case your policy statement does not get into the process here, simply because of the time, we will prepare over the course of the next several weeks a booklet or something in which everybody's policy statement is placed, organized under the theme which with which it is associated, so that you will have this, and you will have this document you can use. I will do my best to have what is relevant to the particular topics that we're dealing with here right now, ready for you this afternoon or in the morning. With that, there is coffee here, and you can be about your policy planning sections. I'll see you at 1:30 here.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fine.
Well, John, do you want us to go to any of these sessions or not?
Sure, if you want to. Now, let me ask you a question about this presentation here. I didn't know whether you were ready this afternoon.